Welcome to On the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the spot where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, brains. There's only one requirement to hang out on the edge, is that you open your big brain and close your small mind. Did you bring your thinking caps? It's time to put them on, because the conversation starts now.
I can't complain. I just had a wonderful breakfast. I'm full.
I love it.
And you are the queen of everything that is good and healthy. So.
I had
maple syrup and bread and grease and potatoes. It was awful.
I eat everything. I love chocolate. Oh, I live on chocolate.
You like the imposter white chocolate?
No.
You like dark chocolate?
Dark chocolate.
I don't like dark chocolate. It's bitter.
Yeah, you've got to get the right one. Aldi chocolate.
I got the right one. and it ain't bitter. So welcome to On the Edge with me, the place where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. I'm so glad to have you, Caroline Bellinger from Australia.
Awesome to be here, April.
And so we're going to talk about all things wonderful that are you. You are a woman that has been able to edit, shift, pivot, overcome, adapt, and thrive. And I'm so glad to have you. You are in fitness. Yes. You want to talk a little bit about sexuality, mental health, yes. The destruction of, you know, drugs, what it can do to you and it doesn't do for you, and a whole lot of other good stuff. So I'm glad to have you here on the edge. Welcome yourself here and tell my brains a little bit more about you.
Well, lovely to be here. My story is very complicated, complex roller coaster of life, but it's, you know, I always look at it's made me what I am today. And, you know, none of us get through life unscathed. You know, it would be, we sometimes think it would be lovely if life would just be like smooth, but we wouldn't grow, we wouldn't learn, we wouldn't be able to do all those fabulous things that we do as we grow older as people. So, yeah, my story started when I grew up, I had a lovely family, grew up in country Victoria. So I'm sure it's very much like in America, in the country, you know, everyone knows everyone. It's pretty chilled out, you know, lovely lifestyle, everyone's supportive community. There was nothing, I loved animals when I was younger. I used to bring home all the stray cats that I could find, much to my parents' dismay. But we ended up keeping quite a few. And I wanted to be a vet when I grew up. So, you know, at the time, fitness was never anything that interested me. Unfortunately, my journey turns a little bit dark when I was about 7 years old, and I was groomed by an uncle and experienced sexual abuse by my uncle from about the age when grooming from the age of 7 to like 17.
Let me stop you right there. This is what I'm trying to understand. Not placing any judgment, but my brains want to know. And I want to know too. How somebody have access to you like that for 10 years and nobody suspects anything? Nobody questions anything, you know, you don't say anything. And I can understand why, because they're grooming you to not feel that you are being abused, but to be make you feel like you're loved and you're wanted and it's okay and don't tell. But for 10 years, I don't know how someone can miss that. Did the uncle live there with you or?
No. So, yeah, and this is one of the main reasons I talk so openly about this, because I think many people actually have a misconception of how child abuse occurs. You know, we talk to our kids a lot these days about stranger danger. which is great, and they should be aware of that. But in reality, very, very few children will be abused by a stranger. Mm-hmm. Most children, and I think globally it's about 1 in 10, will be abused, sexually abused, and it's often by someone they know. So for me, I think it's the grooming process that we possibly don't talk about enough of how it occurs. So I was the youngest, had an older brother, older sister. I thought my brother was smarter and my sister was more beautiful. So I had the third child syndrome of the youngest, feeling like I wasn't good enough right back then. My parents didn't treat us any differently, really. It was, you know, I think that's the other thing. We're all born differently. We all have different personalities, and I probably craved attention more. So I used to run away from home all the time down the street, going, nobody loves me, right? And it was this one Christmas that my uncle came after me and took me back to the house. And from that day on, he started making me feel like I was special, you know, and that's where he'd buy me toys. You know, he still did things for my brother and sister, but not the same. I then over time started staying, it was with my, it was my brother's sister and her, it was her husband. So they never had children either. And I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing, but they never did. I'm not really sure the reasons for that. Anyway, so I used to then go and stay with them on holidays, and they would take me to theme parks and the zoo. And again, I felt loved. So I think the important thing to remember in the grooming process in the start is the vulnerability of certain children. So as a child, I had that, already had that vulnerability that I was looking for someone to feel loved. I already felt insecure. So I became the perfect child, really, to be groomed. And we have to remember, we're going back, not that I, you know, look, I'm 52, but we've got to go back, you know, over 40 years. No one spoke about child sexual abuse, especially not when it involved domestic people you knew. You might have heard the odd stranger abducting a child on the news, but that's about as far as it ever went on that. So the, because no one talk, when people don't talk about stuff, we allow the perpetrator to go unnoticed because people aren't aware of what signs to look for. They're unaware of the whole conversation around it. And from that, it just, you know, it just slowly escalated where he'd want to touch me or look at me naked. But it happened over this 7 year, you know, or 10 year period. So it was so subtle. And by that stage, you know, as I got older, I might have known that it was not okay.
But it became familiar, it became the regular, and it was our little secret. You know?
Yes.
And if you, if you do this, then I'll do this. And then once you're, you become aware of it, then now, okay, if you tell we've been doing this for so long, then, you know, they're going to think it's your fault. And then you went, the whole conversation is fucked up. Excuse my French.
It totally. And there was also, it's even more subtle than that. Part of me didn't want to lose his love without him even overtly saying, don't tell anyone.
Because he was the one that made you feel special.
Yeah, I'm going, like, if I say anything, I might lose all this attention and this love and these trips and these holidays. So where it got, probably it got worse, was that I went to university. I didn't get into veterinary. I missed out by one mark. So I went to and did pharmacy because my dad was a pharmacist, and that was the, you know, my next choice. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. When I got to university, I was living on campus. I was 17 at the time. I then found boys and alcohol. So I never told anyone about the abuse up to this age. At this age, it was still There was no sexual intercourse. There was just touching and kissing my breasts mostly. When I went to uni, he lived in Melbourne. My parents lived in country Victoria. My uncle used to come and visit me at uni. And I still remember to this day, he would come in, close the door, lock it, and then get me to lie on the bed. And he would just start touching me and kissing me, mostly on my breasts again. And I would just lie there in a catatonic sort of state. But again, he used to bring me money and gifts. So I would be thinking, you know, I was a poor student as well. You know, $50, I remember it was $50 back then, which was a lot of money. And that would give me money to go out and drink and party.
So what broke the cycle?
He one day said to me, can you pull down your pants? And that was, and I went, no. And eventually
because you might have experienced that with some of those college boys. And you was like,
I'd actually slept with quite a few boys by this stage because I had misassociated love and sex.
Right. Oh, yeah. Right.
So every boy I slept with, I thought loved me. And again, so it was all around that trying to be validated, trying to feel loved, all that stuff. I said no. I rang my parents and told them that I was failing at university and I wanted to come home. I was failing at university too, but that was because I was drinking and partying and, you know, had all this other stuff going on. I did actually tell a few people at uni what was going on, including the deputy vice dean at the time. Oh, but nothing was ever really said or spoken about. So I just went home on the pretense that I was failing university and didn't tell anyone at the time.
All right. So then the uncle, he after that point, no more. He said, this is over with. Did you tell your family at that point?
No, I didn't tell my family for about another 4 years.
Wow.
When I was drunk at a party and something happened with my boyfriend, and I remember walking out of the house, you know, we're all drunk, and my mum saying, we've done everything for you, and da-da-da-da-da, and me saying back, if you did everything, why did Uncle Jack abuse me?
Yikes.
Yeah, and left her on the bed in tears, and it was horrible. But after that, you know, I came back home the next day. My parents were very upset, but we still never spoke about it because, again, they believed that talking about it would upset me. I believed talking about it would upset them. So we just went through.
And nobody cared about whether it upset Uncle Jack. You know,
It was all about protect. I think I heard later on, years later, that my dad wanted to kill him. Mm-hmm. But it was all about keeping everyone else, you know, and there's all that stigma, that family shame.
Well, you know, it's a new day.
Yeah.
And I tell parents right now, I told my daughter, early age, you know, 2-3 years old, good touch and bad touch.
Yep.
If mommy touch you and you don't feel comfortable, if daddy touch you, you don't feel comfortable, your brother.
Yes.
But see, I always kept a watchful eye. I was a helicopter mom. We had a particular neighbor that was very strange.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm very intuitive. And I told her, if the house catch on fire, that's not the house you run to. She would go to school. Do you need a ride up the hill? Absolutely not. You know, you don't talk. I said, and you fight, you scream, you scratch. I told her about that. And I always made her sexuality seem like a precious jewel.
Yeah.
You are so special. You are so wonderful. You are so unique. You know, no one is like you. You need to be validated. You need to be honored. When you do something like this, you know, sex is beautiful, but it needs to be under the right circumstances. They need to take a shower. You know, with all of these things, and you don't start having the conversation about sex and sexuality at 13 and 14.
No,
Okay? They've been fondling since they were 5 or 6. Exploring the body is natural.
Yes.
What's not natural is when someone else is doing this. And I say that you should tar and feather these people, put them in the town square and stone them because they know better. I don't understand what the fascination is with a child. And you will hear people say, oh, well, you know, they've went to therapy. Talk therapy? I don't know. There's something going on. Now, some people can be healed. I'm not saying that they can't.
Yeah.
But this is awful. And women are perpetrators too.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so don't just sit here and just blame men all the time.
Oh, God, no. And I think, you know, an interesting thing that they're doing, they've just brought in law. And it's like conversations are changing a lot in Australia around that. But they've actually just brought in a law in Australia thanks to a young girl who did a, you know, pretty much a campaign through social media, and it's called a consent. So that what they're going to do is mandatory teaching of consent in school. From, you know, from a young age, teaching yes, no to girls and boys so that they understand right back to that simple consent. Right.
But, you know, and what I don't understand is my parents are so afraid. You know, it's a lot of epigenetics. It's a lot of childhood. You know, you look in the African-American community, just as an example, a lot of, you know, not a lot, but, you know, sexual indiscretion happens. Again, you don't talk about it. You're shamed in the church. You're fast. You're the fast one. You're the one flirting around these people and all that. It's your fault. Or pregnancy. They get pregnant, and then they would give the child to the aunt or cousin and have them raise it as if they're their child, when it's your child. But that happened from slavery. You know, they were victimized. I still don't understand it. Okay, so you go through this trauma.
Yes.
And you go through, you know, alcohol, and, you know, you said you had a bout with drugs. What was your turning point? What was the point where you just said, you know what, let me turn this around?
Yeah, so, you know, drugs and alcohol just became a way of life for me. And, you know, as we do, we just then hang around people who do the same so that we don't have to look at our own issues because everyone's doing it. We normalize it. I had some great jobs, but I moved around a lot in Australia. I lived overseas for a few years. I got pregnant when I was 32. I was still drinking and not drugging a lot, but I had, you know, occasionally. I actually found out I was pregnant at an abortion clinic, and I was 22 weeks, but barely showing. And to me, again, I was at that point of self-hatred. I'd had suicide attempts over the years. I didn't believe that any child deserved me as a parent, and that was my reasoning behind, you know, not having a baby. I then obviously couldn't do anything, so went to and had counselling for adoption. So I was going to adopt my child. On day 4, after he was born, I still was going through with the adoption. And then on day 5, I looked at him while I was bottle feeding and went, I guess we're stuck together. I wouldn't say I didn't have maternal instincts. I still don't have maternal instincts.
Maternal instincts. You have the instinct to love. You know right from wrong.
Yes.
You feed them, you clothe them, you don't beat them.
but I certainly didn't go all googar over having a baby. I still don't like carrying other people's babies. Give me a kitten or a puppy dog and like I'm all in. But yeah, I just don't have baby pink wrinkly babies. So I kept my child. My parents were going to help me out. My dad then got cancer. So he passed away 10 months later. So that was, another very traumatic year. I was still drinking and drugging. not drugging so much, drinking a lot. It was when my son was about seven. I'd had a couple of jobs at this stage. I'd moved in, I was living by myself with him, raising him. And I just felt so much guilt about not remembering what we had for dinner. He was a beautiful, easy child. He slept right through from early on. I always say the universe, gave me what I needed, because I wouldn't have coped with a difficult baby. And he was anything but, and the most beautiful, calm-natured child. We do have a little saying where we say there was a little spirit in the sky. He was a little spirit in the sky, and he looked down and he went, "Oh, fuck, that woman needs help. I better go to her."
That's crazy.
And that's how we ended up together. So he was seven when I went, "I can't do this anymore." I was exhausted. I was broken. And yet I had this beautiful, gorgeous human being who I was responsible for. To most people, I was still a reasonably good mother. He got fed. He went to school. I worked. I was a very highly functioning alcoholic. Just on the inside, I was completely broken. So
you go through this with your son.
Yes.
And then you decide that, I'm going to break the cycle of alcoholism, for me. Yes. Because it wasn't for your son. It had to be for you first. And that's what people have to understand, is that it has to be for you, and it has to be something that you want. It's great to wish for it. It's great to have mom and dad say, "This is what you need to do." But then you look down at that little face and you know that you're their only hope, but you're also their reflection. You are who they're living up to. I remember we were in the car, me and my daughter. And I don't know what happened. And she looked at me with those big brown eyes. And she says, "Mommy, I watch and listen to every single thing you do." And my heart literally dropped. And I said, "I'm trying to be a good example." And she said, "You are." And that just did something to me, but it made me overly cautious about things I said, because she was at that parent stage where she would repeat what I say.
Yeah.
Or, she'd be in my conversation. I had to tell her, "You stay in a child's place." So it was very hard. So when you decided to reinvent your life,
yes,
what steps did you take?
So throughout my 20 years of drinking and drugging, I'd done a little bit of counseling, a little bit of therapy, but not a lot. I went back to a drug and alcohol counsellor, and I got myself into a 6-month residential rehabilitation centre.
Mm.
So it was brutal. It was one of the toughest rehabs in Australia. There was no, as my son always says, we laugh when we first walked in the gate, because we looked at the brochure, the pictures on the website, and his first thing to me was, "It doesn't look like anything like the brochure, Mum." I was imagining spas and beach walks and all that movie, all that stuff you see on the movies.
Yeah, the Betty Ford Clinic here in the United States. Yeah. Mm-mm.
Yeah. No, it was bunks, and you did work duty. And because it was a therapeutic community, you're in there at all times with about 25 other addicts. And most of your therapy is your interactions with them.
Wow. Yeah, a friend of mine went through a program, and she was very hostile. And she says, "Who wants to be in a goddamn mental institution?"
Yep.
And I would think that it was something that would be calming. It would be relaxing. You'd go in these nice, you'd have nice food and all that. She says, "No, there's screaming and there's yelling, and people they're trying to kick the drugs, and they want out, and they're combative and fighting." So it can be as equally hostile,
yes,
trying to break this cycle as it is actually living through it and going through it. I guess that's why Amy Winehouse said, You want me to go rehab? And I said, no.
And look, and the sad reality is that I was there for 6 months. I did 6 months of the program. In that time, there were probably 150 people came and went. And of the people that get, even after 6 months rehabilitation, even the people who get to 6 months, probably only 20% of those stay sober. The rates for AA are like 1 in 12 people stay sober. Like, addiction is brutal.
It is.
And it's an illness and it's an addiction and there's so much underlying. You know, most people I've met who've had any type of addiction have intense trauma, mm-hmm. you know, underlying it. Very few, you know, and it's hard. And like you said, being my first 2 years sober back out in the real world were soul destroying because I had all these emotions and I was still trying to work out how to use them or what to do with them or how to manage them. And like
how,
I said,
and how to protect them because you count each day. You know, yeah. I guess when you're an addict, I've never had that situation. I've been a partier now, don't get me wrong, but I've never had an addiction. I've always had a limit. I've always had a baseline. It's, you know what? This is getting a little, and I have partied with some of the best in Hollywood, baby. It's unbelievable. But I would look and I would say, you know what? This is not a good scene. This is not something that I want to do. So I always internally had this switch and this gauge. And then I had a hell of a mom and dad that would, you know, so yours would talk therapy, mine would bust therapy. You ain't putting up with that. You know, you ain't going to be living here stealing my money and doing all that kind of stuff, having people running in and out. But it was a conversation. And I can understand, you know, where people are at. So, you know, if you have a drug or alcohol problem, Brains, reach out to someone. But again, it's got to start with you. And don't be afraid to go to these treatment programs. All of them are not way out. They've changed. They've, you know, they have different technologies. They're doing a lot of yoga. They're doing a lot of emotional freedom technique. They're doing a lot of Reiki. They're doing a lot of subconscious work. And that's what you're doing now with your spouse.
And that's what I found for me. Like when I got out, so I was going to AA meetings. Alcoholics Anonymous, I did always find them like I felt I had to go, like I knew I had to go because that's all I knew at the time, but I did find them incredibly depressing. I found them a bit dark. So around that time, a couple of years in, I got back into more exercise and then I found running, which was my thing. So running for me is my absolute go-to for mental health. And even now, if I'm cranky, if I go for a run a couple of kilometers in, I'll just have this sense of and I'm like a different person. So
I'm not gonna have these D's bouncing up and down. I can't. I'll ride my bike. I'll ride my bike or I'll do a fast little trot, but I can't do running and the pounding, but it's a certain discipline too.
Yeah. Oh, look, but I say to look my clients now, so I own a gym now and, you know, most of my clients, I say, just do anything, but even walking around the block is a good thing for mental health. Any type of, and if you can do it outdoors, I have this connection. I think the outdoors, fresh air, nature, definitely adds that extra bonus to be able to do it. But if you can't, you know, inside's fine. But any type of stimulation of your body physically stimulates the hormones. So, you know, all those feel-good hormones start acting. And so we can, you know, there's so many things we can do to self-regulate our bodies and our hormone levels, you know, and whether that's yoga or meditating, you know, if you don't want to do something more active, something more, reading a book, sitting on the couch, reading a book is a form of meditation.
Right.
So there's, and it's about finding what makes you feel good and not being scared to go, no, I need time out for me.
Right.
Because especially in today's world, we're all so busy.
Well, and then we're scared with the COVID monster out there. We've been in isolation. You yes. have been a part of some anthologies, some book writing. Tell us a little bit yes. about that.
So I've been part of two books. I've got one here. That's my first one was Empowering Women, Empowering the World.
Oh, wait, hold on. Let me see that. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, so that's how I started with my book writing. And it was all about, it's a group of women. Now, everyone has overcome an obstacle, but they're all so varied and different. And that's what I loved about it. I love that, you know, it's that saying that everyone you meet has their own challenges. Mm-hmm. So be kind, because you just don't know. And for me, it was about, A, working with a group of women together and empowering each other through the process. But it's also about letting people know that, you know, and we're all, when I say average women, no one's average, but, you know, we're normal women. No one's movie stars or famous or rich or whatever. We're just normal women going about our everyday lives who've overcome challenges and then gone on to have like fabulous success or happy lives, or, you know, some, for some people, the benchmark's not even that high. Sometimes the benchmark might be, if you're in addiction, the benchmark might be get out of addiction.
Right.
That's just as powerful as going on to be successful and happy.
Or, and just, you as know, challenging. There's other things too on the flip side, you know, just not just the downtroddenness of drug abuse, mm-hmm. but the overachiever syndrome.
Oh. Yes.
You know, the imposter syndrome, the trying to keep up with the Joneses, the self-loathing, the body, you know, dysmorphia, how people don't like yeah. how their bodies feel, their relationships with their spouse. There's so many things that are going on in the world, but there's a lot of good going on in the world, too. There's inspiration. There's motivation. There's great people like Caroline that are working to overcome and adapt and also pull your sister along with you.
Yes.
You know, you're not just out there just kind of hanging in the la-la land. Oh, okay, well, I've got it. No, you are extending the olive branch to other women, you know.
And I think you touched on something really important there, because we, again, I say to people, you get to curate your life. And if you're on social media and you've got people on social media who are negative or hating or, you know, racist or sexist, just block and delete them. You don't owe them anything.
You don't even know them. I say they have keyboard courage. Because you wouldn't say that stuff to my face. You show
no, up. No, but, you know, but even in real life, like if people are negative, I just don't hang around them. And that's what I've learned as I've got sober, is my boundaries. And I was reading something the other day. It's not, boundaries aren't about telling other people how to act. It's about telling people what you accept. So it's always about you. It's not about them. They can, you know, I could go off and be an asshole for the rest of your life. That doesn't impact me, because I've got a boundary that's not going to let you in my life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's some people that will try to suck the oxygen out of the room. You know, yeah. Like I had a conversation with someone, and I'm doing something very special for my daughter, and they go, oh, so you're going to handicap her. And I'm like, absolutely not. No, you're going to make her weak. And I said, you know what? Something can't be weak if it's built on a strong foundation. How about that? And whatever I have, I'm going to give to my child. Be it education, be it finance, be it love, be it, you know, a good book. Because they deserve that. How is your son?
My son is 20. Now he actually just popped in yesterday to say hi. Oh, cool. I think he was on his phone for a lot of it. But
his physical presence was there.
Yeah, his physical presence was there. He moved out. He's about an hour away in the city working. He did university. Do you know what? He was school captain in primary school. He went on to school captain in high school. So, you know, that's one of the stories probably the thing I'm the most proud of is that I've raised a really kind, generous human being. And, you know, and to me, that's what I wanted out of it. You know, I never pushed him. Like, he did architecture at university. That's what he wanted to do. And I've always said, if that's what, follow what you want to do, what makes you happy. He's now selling cars. Because he loves cars and he's making some good money, so that's cool.
So how do you think that he will process this? And I know no one has a template, no one knows, but how do you think that he'll take these life lessons and these experiences that he's experienced with you, being the observer, but also being the recipient and of what's going on, and process this through his own life? Do you have those kind of conversations?
Yeah. Look, we're so close. And, you know, I've always been open and transparent with him, you know, and especially around drugs and alcohol and relationships, you know, and we make a bit of a laugh. He's his father, who is not in the picture. We haven't heard from him for a while, but he's an alcoholic as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so I always have this conversation, you know, we've always had this conversation now. Father alcoholic, mother alcoholic. When you first go out drinking, darling, I would be very aware of your behaviors around drinking, because genetically speaking,
there's
a risk factor. Mm-hmm. But he, do you know what, his nature is almost, it's the same as mine in that, like, generosity and all that, but he's different personality. He's very calm. He doesn't seem to have that same manic approach to life that maybe I do. But, you know, we've talked about, he's my biggest support when it comes to even my trauma around childhood sexual abuse, as I've dealt with that. You know, we talk about that. We competed in triathlon together for many years. We represented Australia together in Switzerland just before COVID.
It's about the dialogue. That's the only thing that we have, brains, is dialogue and communication. Mm-hmm. And the more you try to hide and conceal these things, it just festers.
And he talks to me now about whether he's taken some drugs on a night out or drank, or whether he's had a girlfriend and all that. So I always wanted an open conversation. Mm-hmm. And the only way to have an open conversation with a child, in my experience, is to be open and honest to them.
Right. But, you know, there's an appropriate time.
Absolutely.
And your situation is a little different, and it might be, you know, common to some. You were very fortunate that you were able to still raise your child, be, you know, functional to a degree, that, you know, your child was not subjected to, because when you're around people that are drugging and drinking, you know, there's a high risk factor that you're going to be with some other folks that's drinking and drugging, and they're going to do something inappropriate. So able to dodge the bullet on that.
Yeah, most of my drinking was probably done at home by myself. Mm-hmm. So that he was never around any violent situation, you know, and I never would have allowed any type of violence.
Good.
And I've never been around that. That's never been part of my story. But I think just building that trust with them and letting, you know, I think it's important for children to understand that as a parent, you're not perfect and you have vulnerable moments and that you struggle. And then you show them how you get through that. Mm-hmm. So you teach them that. I think, you know what, I think one of the main things that will be an issue for him is actually probably the fact that his father chose not to be in his life.
Yeah.
I think that's probably more impactful than
As he gets older and he's able to look at it through a different lens, as he matures, he might look at it as a blessing.
Oh, look, we definitely think it's a blessing. You know? the last communication from his father was not so, how can I put it, role model-ish, I'm going to say.
But he's damaged, and hurt people. But how are you helping people, Caroline? Tell us about that. Tell us about the beautiful work that you're doing there at the gym and all of the different modalities and what you're offering people there.
Yeah, so when I got into the gym, I got in around mental health and making people feel good about themselves. I didn't realize how unhealthy the fitness industry and the health industry and the beauty industry could be and how damaging it is. So I take almost an opposite approach of absolutely no dieting, absolutely no shred 6 week, get your figure in a couple of weeks programs. We work from the inside out. You know, I say to, you know, all my clients, once you start liking yourself and truly liking yourself, the good, the bad, the ugly, you'll start making healthier choices because it's a lifestyle thing. And healthier choices sometimes are a piece of chocolate cake. If you're out at a birthday party and there's chocolate cake, there's life, and you have to enjoy that. Health isn't defined by weight. All those things that the industry, you know, tells us that are bad or we should feel shame or guilt around, I do the opposite. I say feel good about who you are, and over time, doing a bit of exercise, making a few healthier choices with your diet will eventually, you will lose weight to become a healthier you. And that's what we aim for, is a healthier version of you. Then I take that a bit further with my life coaching business. Mm-hmm. And that's more really deep work on, I do a lot of neuro-linguistic programming, hypnosis, to work on those subconscious beliefs that hold us back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because sometimes I think that's the most frustrating thing for people. And even for people in the fitness industry, it's often any issues they have around health is based in trauma that they don't even really understand fully is still controlling them.
Right. But regaining your sexuality after all of this, and I'm talking about the control over your sexuality. Your gender is between your ears. Your sexuality is between your legs. Sometimes you got to put a leash on that thing.
You got
to be able to hold back. You've got to, before you unleash it, okay, you've got to understand who you are, what your pleasure points are, not just sexual stimuli, but is the conversation right? Is the touch right? Is the atmosphere right? Is the person, you know, the person that I'm with, do they have some, you know, some uncanny or very familiar things that will trigger me? You have to think about that. And then regaining that passion, you know, because some people can just, you know, lay down with dogs and get up with fleas. But then there's another thing about true intimacy and really feeling passionate and just really getting ready for the get down. How do you work with a woman to regain that sense of control? Because it is control. The sexual energy right now in the age of Aquarius is off the chart.
Right.
And a lot of young women don't realize that at the age of 40, your libido goes,
boom.
Okay, it wakes up.
Yes. So for me, about 7 years ago, I finished a relationship because it was, again, my pattern of it being very much around the sexual part of the relationship rather than the intimacy part of the relationship. So I broke up then. I actually had 4 years where I didn't date anyone. And that was purely to come back to work on myself. Mm-hmm. And because I honestly believe, unless you've got a partner that's on the same path, that it's very difficult to work on yourself when you're within a relationship that's maybe not functional. If you're in a functional relationship, completely different. But if you're in a dysfunctional relationship and you're trying to work on yourself, it's going to be very difficult to not be influenced by what's happening in the relationship. So I spent 4 years just getting to know me, getting to know who I am, getting to understand boundaries, what I wanted in life, all that sort of stuff. I have actually just recently broken up after a 2-year, I call it the COVID relationship, because it sort of happened all over COVID. And again, I thought I'd found that intimacy, and I was, you know, it didn't work out. He didn't want commitment. Anyway, after 2 years.
You know what? And you roll your eyes and all that. But what I've learned, well, I can talk because I've been married to Mr. Magnificent for 37 years. But one thing that I always knew about myself is that I don't want nobody that don't want me.
No, and, well, that's...
Exactly. And if you are not in it, love me enough to let me go. Let me go to be with someone else. But what do you think about self-gratification in these laws? You don't have to self-disclose or anything like that. But for women that find that there is a shame in masturbation or sex toys or sex pleasuring, you know, and you can go from a flicker to a flame. You could be a person that's addicted to pornography. How do you find that balance?
Yeah, and I think it's like anything. Yeah, I absolutely think women should pleasure themselves, you know, and learn. And, you know, the great thing with, and this is where we talk about, you know, there's so many great things out there. There's so many knowledgeable women sharing advice on how to pleasure yourself. There's female pornography, based, you know, not just that old school pornography that has women screaming over stuff that most women wouldn't probably find pleasure in. You know,
ain't nothing wrong with a little, what do they say, pull my hair, slap my ass, and call me the bitch. Ain't nothing wrong with that sometimes.
No. So I think, like, women should just be, you know, everything about, you know, whether you believe in God or you have your own spirituality, we were designed the way we're designed to have pleasure.
That's right.
Now, this is what people forget, you know, and I know a lot of religions teach against that. But you know what? I go, God wouldn't make us have pleasure, feel pleasure, if he didn't want us to use it.
He wouldn't have made that area the root chakra, the place to plant seed, grow, and produce life.
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
But
he didn't make it a train station either.
yeah, not New York Station here.
Right.
But I think it's also an important thing, and what I find with a lot of women I work with in the fitness industry is one of the first steps about pleasuring yourself is also learning to love your body. Mm. And that's your body as it is, not how you want your body to be in 12 months of going to the gym. How your body is today is what you need to love. And part of loving your body is pleasuring your body and getting to know your body. So I think it's
releasing that. It's a release of endorphins. It is cleansing.
Yeah.
It's a release of stress.
If you don't like running, that's a perfect way to get rid of your stress.
You know, it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. And there's no age limit on that either.
No.
I won't tell you who this is, but I had a friend of mine in her 80s ask me to take her to the adult sex shop.
I love it.
I didn't know what to say. I was like, and she says, well, I came to you because I trust you. And I'm like, damn, why you gotta trust me? Wait a minute. Not only did she go in there and find what she wants, she told the lady, she says, and I'd like some extra batteries.
I love it.
And I thought it was cute, but I was like, you know what? She's in her 80s and she still has a desire. She still has a need. She still wants to be pleasured. And there is no shame associated with that. None.
I think it's so important as we age to understand that we're not limited by our age. We're limited by what we think of our age.
Absolutely.
But, you know, all the rest of it. And I find, I was just saying too, I went swimming yesterday. I did a bit of ocean swimming and it's beautiful conditions and it's just such a lovely feel. I was talking to one of the ladies and we were, because the club was closed, we had to get changed and we were on the main street in our cars, getting out of our swimmers into our clothes. And I'm yelling across the car at her going, don't you love it when you get to the age and you just don't give a shit if anyone sees you anyway?
You don't. And it's a beautiful thing because it's very liberating. Well, Caroline, thank you so much for, you know, just opening your heart and your mind and sharing your story with us. It has been compelling. Please tell my brains how to get in contact with you if they're there locally in Australia, or your online programs, your coaching programs, please. How can we reach out to you?
So you can get me on my website is www.carolinebellinger.com. On my Instagram or TikTok or Facebook, it's Caroline Ballinger Official. So, yeah, reach out. Just send me a message anytime. Just follow. I do videos all the time on my social media about trauma or healing, you know, just, you know, fun stuff as well. I like a good TikTok dance because you're not too old. You're never too old for that.
Girl, that tickety tock, I'm telling you, it'll work you out. And they're so entertaining. My daughter sits here like your son probably. She says, I'm coming over to visit. I said, no, you're coming over to my house to watch your TikTok. Is what you really
Yep.
But thank you so much, Brains. I need you to handle your business. And tickety is so fancy.
That's the one.
There's nothing wrong with it. Talk to your children about sexual abuse. Talk to them about drugs. Talk to them about alcohol. Have the conversation. At least they can say that they were warned. At least they can say that they know. Take them through a drive through adverse communities and let them see where they could eventually end up.
Yes.
If things don't work out.
And also, don't pretend that you didn't do stuff when you were younger.
Exactly. Kids
see straight through that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So thank you again, Caroline.
Thank you.
You are amazing.
Thank you.